welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the final part of our exclusive interview with former SAS soldier and ABC television executive Barry Wynn, author of Breath in the Dark, Jane Hersey, and Thomas Barlow from Real Media, a Manchester new media startup which is taking over where the London media has failed. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. What about the modern world? Let's just bring it up to the present because, you know, the golden age of television is gone. The golden age of the film is gone. We've got these various different crises now, haven't we? We've got the Middle East seems to be regime change every 5 minutes, with West against East, a kind
never
of new
changes.
Almost a new Cold War, and also the financial problems that are right across Europe. What do you make as someone you know, with all this experience from the past of these major problems we've got in the world today still?
Well, as ever, we have to look to our youth. But unfortunately, this is only a very personal opinion, the youth of today have become totally materialistic, really, and they think life is just a bowl of cherries. They don't realise what my father's generation did for this country in fighting that thing. And the fact that they live in peace now, certainly in our country and most of Europe, it's quite insignificant because they never tasted the fear that we had. I remember during the war, we were frightened to death of the arrival of the Germans. And they've lived in such easy life by comparison.
Yeah. You say they've been mollycoddled?
Well, I believe in the youth. I've always believed in the youth. We've gone through this a million times, you know, in our past. But they have to learn. And one hopes that with sort of reservations about Europe. We would all like to be in a Europe. I mean, it was Winston Churchill who first talked about passport-free Europe and all the rest of it. And it was always conceived as a marketplace of which we would be a member. Now it's become, you know, a nation state, if they could get it there. And the bureaucracy. Oh.
The other thing, of course, is that we're seeing a big gap opening up between rich and poor in Britain again, aren't we?
Yes, I think that is extraordinary. It's a phenomenon, really. I mean, this is the materialistic part of it, isn't it, really? Money is all important. And there are certain people that know how to make it, and that, you know, I'm afraid it's one of the things, greed.
We have Chancellor George Osborne. I mean, I know you live in Cyprus, so you may be not on top of what's going on in Britain, but he says he's going to balance the books, and he says to do it, we've got to spend less as a government. But that itself seems to be strangling off the economy.
Well, I don't think we strangled off the economy. I think it's worked. I think it's worked. It's very unpleasant. But if you want to make money, you've got to have the right people at the top to make it, and they've got to have the reason for doing it. I don't like it. This is the way the Americans do it.
I mean, we're sitting here in Wales today, Port Talbot Steelworks. They're now talking about the possibility of that closing. That does suggest there simply isn't the demand out there. There isn't the building going on. There isn't the need for these basic things for industry like steel.
Yes, I know. Well, I think they're totally wrong, of course. I mean, a little ridiculous thing. I do my own mending of my clothes and things like that. Needles that we used to have before the war from Sheffield Steel were so sharp at the point that, you know, if you happened to touch your fingernail with the point, it would go in and you bleed, because it was the finest possible steel. Needles today, and the cotton, is rubbish. And it all comes from China. What's the matter with us?
Well, it almost sounds like the 1984, you know, George Orwell's book, where he talks about the cigarettes, where as if you tip the cigarette slightly, all the tobacco rolls out the end of it.
Yes, I know. It is, you know. Of course, this always moves in a cycle. It will come round. We will realise, you know, the error of our ways, I think. But I believe in the Commonwealth, actually. I think that the Commonwealth, if you look at the globe, I've just written an article about it, as a matter of fact, from, I was asked, actually, by the same publisher to go down and interview, with a possibility of doing a book, Dr. Barnes Wallace, as he then was. And so I did what I was told to do. I was still in the television world, but I sort of got onto this thing that you don't write one book. If it's a success, you've suddenly got a hell of a tax problem, and so you've got to do another one, and it sort of gets into a mad cycle that never seems to get finished off. So Ernest said, I think this is a book in Dr. Barnes Wallace. He's an amazing man. I said, oh, I don't even know who he is. He said, well, he's this and that and the rest of it. Go down and see him. I said, very well. So I went down, and I found him on the old Croydon airport in a section of Nissen huts left over from the Second World War. I'm a young whippersnapper, no school certificate, don't forget. And now to be questioning this brilliant mathematician. I walked in correctly on time. Very, very nice elder gentleman got up and said, how nice to meet you, do come in. We sat down. And I looked around the Nissen huts and I noticed something. Because I'm not a talented person, but I am an observer, that I must say. And I noticed that all the people there were girls. And I thought, well, that's strange. So we were trying to open conversation. And I said, there are no men here. He said, no, I won't work with men. I said, why is that? You see, laughing. And he said, always got something else on their mind. This was, don't forget, before the age of computers. He said, all I want is mathematical results. I put down on a piece of paper to girl number one, work this out. When you've done so, give me the answer. And I spread it out around my thing. They concentrate totally on what they're doing. And I find that I can work far better with women, young graduate mathematicians, and that's the way I work. And so a very interesting conversation came out of this. He said, do you know the name Bartholomew? I am an uneducated young man. I said, do you mean the map maker? I didn't know that. He said, yes, a mathematician. Oh, I said that. He said, have you ever thought of why the meridian of zero runs through Greenwich? Well, I said, no, not really. He said, it is because, as a mathematician, if you were to try and work out the focal point of the five continents on this planet, there is only one place that zero can go. And that goes on the line through Greenwich. Whether it's true or not, I've not the remotest idea, but that's what he told me, and I'm a student at the seat of this man. And so he said, don't forget, it's 50 years ago. He said, I cannot understand for the life of me why the aero industry, he worked for British Aircraft Corporation, are trying to do the most difficult technical thing it's possible to conceive. I said, oh, what's that, Dr. Wallace? To drive ever bigger, ever heavier aircraft ever faster through the thickest part of the atmosphere. He said, it's the most difficult thing you can possibly do. He said, 200,000 feet above us is unlimited energy force. We shouldn't be going fighting with huge weights of fuel and everything else to get into that. What we should be doing is going up slowly to counter gravity, slip it into the jet stream, and he said we'll be able to go to Sydney in 90 minutes, including takeoff and landing. That is all I can tell you with my hand on my heart, is what he told me. Now we've got the things. And do you know something? I think he's probably right. We need little tiny things with miniaturized power force. How they do that, I don't know. But just slowly to go up there, flick it in there, and there we are. We've got all that space, unlimited fuel, get around the globe in no time at all. That's what he told me.
What about Britain today? Because, I mean, everybody was very impressed by Britain's empire, although obviously there were a lot of people around the world that came a cropper. We've just had recently the Australian universities saying actually Australia wasn't colonised, it was invaded, it was surrounded, and it was there was a genocide that went on in Australia. So there is a lot of questioning.
By Australians. You're talking about genocide.
Well, I'm talking about the original takeover. I mean, the British, for example, over in North America as well. The Native Americans, many of those were killed, and there's been a lot of genocide by the British over the centuries. Many people see us as the bullies, the
British,
bullies of the world.
To entertain us with all this? No, I don't think so. You see, in the old days of the aristocrats, the eldest son would inherit the estates, which he had to run profitably for the family. The second son had behind a job. What's he going to go into? Well, he might go into law. Then there's the third son. What are we going to do with Harry? Send him to India, or send him to somewhere or another, you see. So they went out there, commercially minded, not militarily minded. I was in Malaysia 2 years after the Japanese had gone out, and already control had been brought back. You know what I mean? We were probably arrogant, but basically we wanted, for the further of trade and one thing or another, a country which was well run. None of these countries were properly run.
Well, some people would say Britain isn't very well run today.
I would agree with you.
What do you think's the future for Britain anyway?
Once again, you come back to the young people. We're a generous nation. I believe in our young people. If we set our mind to it, we can do it. But this business is just because you've got a degree. I've got two daughters. They've got their degrees. And in Cyprus, for instance, I had a conversation because I've got some friends there who have a kiosk, a cigarette kiosk. And I sit there almost every day when I go there. And one of their daughters has just got her degree. She's going to be a doctor. She's got a doctorate and everything else in Glasgow. And we were talking, and she came back for Christmas, and we were talking there. And we were talking about the thing and money and all the rest of it, you see. And she said, I said to her, you've now got your alphabet. She looked at me, she's highly intelligent. I beg your pardon. I said, you've got your alphabet now. This degree has got you your alphabet. I said, this is just the beginning. You won't mean until you're 50 with a wise woman, because you will learn from experience. She said, I spent 8 years doing this. I said, darling, it's the alphabet. Now you've got to put it to work. She was very quiet and probably hated me, but nevertheless, that's what I said. I said the same to my daughters. You know, yes, you've got the degrees, wonderful. That is the start. You've now got an educated mind to know how to tackle these problems, but you've got to sort of, you know, put that to work. So I'm very optimistic in a way, but I mean, there's so many things which are so deplorable. It is dreadful, some of the things that we see, but I suppose it's always been the same.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can remember growing up and seeing the first homeless people on the streets of London, for example, begging, and we're seeing more and more of that today, aren't we?
We are seeing more and more of that. And it's interesting that there's so many ex-forces people amongst the people that are in jail. Now, why is that? I asked myself, why is that? The thing is that very cleverly, the forces have really offered a new family to young people. It is their family. It's the destruction of the families that we've made a mistake in. I remember when my father, he had to go into a terminal hospital for 1 year. It was a ghastly place, to be honest with you. We tried to have him at home, couldn't be done, and he went to this hospital. And it was mostly the nurses were male nurses, and many of them were Chinese. And when he passed away, I managed to get to the hospital, I think 30 seconds before he passed. Just enough time for me to kiss his forehead. And standing there like sentinels were all these nurses, and there was a very nasty atmosphere, smell in this ward. And trying to be nice and to thank one of these Chinese boys standing there, I said, well, thank you very much. I said, what do you do with this problem in China? And he looked at me and he said, we would never allow our parents to end their lives in a place like this. Put me in my place, I mean, you know. And he meant it. We've destroyed the family. Why has that happened? I suppose because people don't believe in their religion anymore. It's destroyed the kind of the texture of life that we had, where you tried to live a good Christian life.
It's interesting, isn't it? A lot of young people say, for example, you ask them who Moses was, they might not be able to tell you.
No, but I mean, I don't think they've ever... I've just given... Well, I don't want to go into this, but why I'm here in Wales is because of the passing of my son. And I had to think for 3 or 4 weeks what to say, and I said it. And I think it all went over reasonably well. And I know that a lot of the young people have never even read the Bible. And actually, I recited the end, as the end thing, the 23rd Psalm, which I've known all my life, of course. And I said to them at the end, I don't know, I didn't say it in these words now, and I can't remember how I said it, only yesterday, but I said, I don't know how many of you have ever read the Bible, but remember that the Bible has been the best-selling book for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it still is. Now then, the philosophy... You can't beat it. You may not be able to do it because we can't do it. It's too hard, but it's yet terribly simple. So I then, because most of my audience were my sons, my grandchildren there, 11 of them, I think it was, who've never ever seen me before. And I said, we will never meet again. Doesn't matter. Lovely to be with you today. It's a sad day, but it isn't a sad day. I said, as I came here, all the daffodils are out. There are lambs in the field. This is a rebirth. You've got to carry on. And I said, I don't know how many of you read the good book. And I'm not a highly religious person in a way, but I keep to my original teachings. I said, but do you know something? I said, there isn't one of you here that won't sometime face a crisis. It may be a broken love affair. It may be that you're facing an operation. And at the moment of dire stress, like before the Battle of Alamein, every officer knew that General Montgomery read a chapter of his Bible every night before he went to bed. I said, the funny thing is, you probably haven't read your Bible. But shall I tell you something? If after I've recited these words to you, you think there's something in them, and you're facing a crisis, I said, flick open your laptop, press Bible, punch in Psalm, punch in 2:3, and you can hear it, because you are carrying the Bible and every word in it every day, but you don't realise it. You may never see it, may never read it on paper, but I said papyrus is where it started. And when I was in the army, I remember a chap in the barrack room say, there's no record of this. It's all rubbish. It's people telling stories. But then suddenly, a few years later, they find the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I took my daughters to see the Dead Sea Scrolls in Jerusalem, because I thought they should see it. I don't think they believe it or anything else. They're just to them, it's a parchment stretched out in the cabinet, and they look at it. But funnily enough, the words are exactly what they are in the Bible, which is very interesting. So I think it's the, I don't know what it is, it's the lack of faith, spirituality, and I think it's very, very sad. But it's still there. I believe in the young people, and gradually they probably will come round to it and say, well, this isn't right, we've got to do something about this. And, you know, it's the way it is. We learn through our experience.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
My name's Thomas Barlow. My cooperative is called Real Media. We launched in 2014 with several years working for Real Fair before that, which became Real Media. Real Fair was a welfare rights blog. And now we've turned into a full media organisation that produces videos, has social media feeds. We aggregate other independent media from around the internet, and we've done a variety of stories, from whistleblowing stories in investigative journalism to media critique, and a lot of stuff on climate change. And we try and cover the gamut, basically, and we're trying to set up a new way of doing media in the 21st century.
But, I mean, a little group like you, how could you ever compete against the monolithic giants, the, you know, the Murdochs, people like that in London?
Well, Murdoch is losing a lot of money currently, and, you know, he retains the press side of his operation purely for political power.
How can he carry on just losing money?
I'm not sure he can. You know, I mean, this is what was shown up by Leveson, that there was a move, a potential move, to de-seat him and sell off the press titles and just keep Sky, which is the one that's making the money. You know, the fact is, the future of the press is uncertain, and in these times we have a lot cheaper way to access. It's a bit like the printing press all over again. Suddenly we've got a cheap way with people who care about it, who are well-trained, to do it in their spare time or for small sums of money. And as we build up, we are preparing for a launch in October of something very, very special, with a lot of celebrities, a lot of full-scale support from across the sector. And this is what is going to turn into a new model of funding journalism in the 21st century.
Well, you say funding, but I mean, even people like The Guardian and The Independent just folded through really lack of advertising.
Yeah, well, there's a lack of advertising because they've also got a lack of circulation. And the circulation comes from the fact that The Independent supported the Conservatives in the last election. The Guardian has been seen as anti-Corbyn and is hemorrhaging readers. The fact is that the press seems biased and seems to be taking editorial lines out of sync with the largest age cohort in Britain now is millennials. They represent 20 million people in this country. It's now a larger age cohort than the baby boomers.
So hang on, who are the millennials?
The millennials are people born after 1982 to the mid-90s. Yeah, the millennials are people like myself who came of age at 18 on the millennium. They're young, internet savvy, have grown up mostly only ever knowing PCs and internet, and they have a different approach. Over 55% of them get their news and information from social media totally. They do not go to single news sources. They do not buy. The understanding the old press has of how to reach these is completely limited by the fact that the doors are closed for our generation to get into those organisations.
But can you actually turn the advertising revenue in order to support yourself?
Well, we won't do it through advertising revenue. What has been shown to work in America especially, they're 6 or 7 years ahead of us with new media, is say an organisation like the Young Turks, which has 250 million views per month. They do it on a subscriber basis, or what is called the freemium model. You give most of your content away for free, and you give a certain amount away paid. People don't pay you for the premium stuff. They do a bit, but mostly they pay you because they recognise what you're doing as a service. And that is the way that the modern economy, it's the way Spotify works, it's the way Wikipedia works, it's the way the biggest organisations in the modern world work. It's something the press hasn't caught up with. They're not going to get it. And the Guardian's tried to move towards a membership model, but the problem is they've tried to move towards a membership model just at the same time as they alienated a great deal of their their readership base. The important thing is that you provide a service for your readership, and that's not advertisers, it's not corporate sponsors, it's not the state, it's going to be the people. And so it's a new democratic age, but it works. It's already making money. You're seeing it in hyperlocal organisations, you're seeing it in small media organisations like Navarra Media and other places across the UK already, and you're seeing it in Amsterdam, in Holland, in Europe, but America especially is leading the way. They have got 20 large independent media organisations, and those are the ones that are powering, for instance, Bernie Sanders currently, because the mainstream media will not give Bernie Sanders any good coverage whatsoever. Now, I'm not saying that media has to be political, but what happens, as the Young Turks like to say, is facts are progressive. So if you're willing to present facts, commentary, everyone on the internet nowadays can fact check things. So it's hard to present the level of bias. It's maybe not bias. It's often been described as, you know, the British press has always taken an interesting editorial line to engage its readership. So whether that's the Daily Mail, the Guardian, the Telegraph, it's always been clearly partisan, but, you know, as a part of a rambunctious debate. But that's not good enough any longer. People are looking for...
I don't know what you're quite getting at there, because I certainly see it as very London-centric. I think of it as the London media that's doing all the national and international coverage.
You're right, it is very London-centric, and that's a great tee-up to say, look, you know, our organisation is based in... we have members in London, but also in Bristol, Manchester, Glasgow. The country we live in is not just London, and in fact, you know, even the people who are living in London feel disassociated from it now. You see it with politicians, you see it with all other parts of the establishment, but you see it with the press and their unwillingness to question certain shibboleths. And it's why people like Nigel Farage get so much support for saying, you know, North London liberal elite, because everyone does feel disconnected from that. I think the press are so wildly disconnected that even when The Guardian does things like diversity recruitment, they end up getting two white ladies, you know, who are over the age of 30. They're not recruiting young people. They're not recruiting people from black and minority ethnicities. They're not recruiting working class people. There are no entrance points for those people in the current media. And if they do get in, they know what the rules are when they get in.
Okay, so your model, members might pay you for premium content. Well, what, give us an idea of what kind of stories you'd be covering for free and what people would have to pay for.
The free stuff would be anything of worth that was newsworthy. The premium stuff would be specific exclusive interviews. It would be, you know, it wouldn't be any of our investigations will always be fully available. That's what we want to get out there, our investigative journalism and anything we're aggregating.
So when you're talking about exclusive interviews, you're talking about YouTubes of celebrities?
Yeah, with celebrities, you know, with this, you know, Frankie Boyle or John McDonald, or, you know, whether it's political people or, you know, interesting people, we'll put up a portion of those interviews, you know, say a clip and say, here, this is very interesting. If you want to get the whole interview, you've got to join up. But more importantly, as I say, what you see with, say, Wikipedia or you know, a lot of models that work on this is the basis is I drop them a tenner because you say, this is fantastic. This is a fantastic service and I'm happy to drop a bit of cash into. And that sounds airy-fairy, but the thing is, the market research is there, and that is how modern tech companies work, and we need to think like modern tech companies, because that's how people are interacting with the world and information. They're the people who shape our access to information. And
well, personally, I wouldn't donate to Wikipedia, because I've seen quite a lot of biased editing, and they have basically a failure to correct erroneous edits and things like that. Their system for appeals, if you want, is almost non-existent, and I use another site called Wikispooks. But I mean, this is the great thing about the internet. As soon as it looks like something starts to be controlled by the establishment, something else almost mimicking it pops up. But anyhow, so getting back to your model, are you actually working from home then?
Yeah, I'm working from home, you know, out and about. We've managed to raise funds through various grants and little bits and bobs, do work on the side, but mostly, yeah, through grants. And you can do comment and analysis from home, but, you know, what's great is that we've got good journalists in the organisation who go out and they're doing investigative journalism. They're doing journalism that actually other people don't have the time to do. So one of our journalists, Cam Sandu, who broke the story about the FCA and the whistleblower, you know, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of resources. Well, we're willing to put that time in. We we've got people who'll go out, they'll find the stories, and we're lucky to be connected to people across the country that do.
Well, there's also another question about this kind of investigative journalism, and that is that traditionally in Britain it was done by the big television networks and ITV networks like Granada, Central Television, people like that, that had massive budgets with staff of maybe 30 people working on one programme, including a full-time barrister. But you surely can't actually match that.
Our plan is going forward in the next year, we've decided to come up with an app that will be called Real Funds, and it will enable people to fund investigative journalism. People will put, much the same as they would to editors, they'll put a pitch together saying, this is something I want to chase down. It may take a year, and this is how we're going to help fund it, you know.
Well, I noticed that Byline Media, I don't know if you've come across them, are doing a similar sort of thing, and that expose about John Whittingdale came from that. Yes. So people say, yes, I want to see a bit of effort put into standing this story up and shoving it out to the national press. Is that the sort of thing you're looking at?
Absolutely. And also, another thing that was talked about, you were talking about the Bristol Cable. We've worked with the Bristol Cable, the Salford Star, and a lot of great local, radical, independent media sources. And one of the things we were talking about is doing independent investigations coordinated across the UK through these independent media organisations. So we bring them together, we put money in a pot, and we share it out. So if there's something that has national significance, say it's something to do with housing, for instance, you know, that there are particular housing interests that are actually similar in Bristol as they are in Manchester, Peel Holdings, maybe, for instance, who are a big housing company that own developments in both areas and have been caught doing some pretty dodgy stuff with councils. We can coordinate that across the country, utilising great journalists that are already out there. But yeah, as you say, that, you know, that you see it with Byline. It's fantastic stuff what they're doing. The Centre for Investigative Journalism, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. People are realising we need specialist investigative journalism, and that people need to be paid for that. There's some great people like Anthony Lowenstein, who's worth following and checking out. And he crowdfunded a year's work on following disaster capitalism in Papua New Guinea, for instance. And there's quite a few examples like this. So
We had a discussion, I think it was about 18 months ago. Talking to some of the people who were working on those big old investigative shows, which were doing, you know, big exposés, which had enormous ramifications, some of them. And really, there's nothing like it anymore in terms of finance. I mean, you're talking about having to fund a team of maybe 15 people, probably for best part of several months, including legal counsel. I mean, you're talking about something like £500,000 to fund one half-hour investigative documentary. Insurmountable for a new media startup.
Absolutely. No, it's true. And in fact, we had a discussion on this. Real Media published a discussion between myself and Aaron Bastani from Navarra Media, where we discussed the future of the BBC and what he suggested, and I concur with him. We can do so much, and I think we can set the agenda, new media. We can create a new model of doing journalism that I hope will grow and grow and grow. But certainly in the short term, that is not going to be anywhere near good enough, and probably not in the midterm either. What we need to look at is the BBC, its funding, and when we're talking about changing the BBC, which Whittingdale is doing, we need to go exactly the opposite direction that the BBC are doing, certainly within journalism. You know, can we use the huge budget that the BBC does have to support more independent journalism, to support more independent journalists, investigative journalists? There certainly are large pots of money there. If we see that as a public good to be used by all for the benefits of all, instead of it being a political football to be kicked about by various governments, that is potentially a future. But yeah, I mean, currently, in the short term, investigative journalism of that sort that you're talking about, the prospects look bleak, and it's a sad loss for this country. We need to step up to the plate.
So how do people find and follow what Real Media is up to online? I suppose it is only online, isn't it? We can't watch you on the television or anything like that.
No, you can't watch us yet. Someday soon we'll get there. You can find us at realmedia.press. You can find us at realmediagb on Twitter, or our Facebook is facebook.com/realmedia. So you can find us at on Facebook, Twitter. You can find us on Tumblr, SoundCloud, iTunes. You can find us at Real Media. And, at the moment, we're doing some good work. But what would be great to look out for is our launch in October. We're going to have some truly special stuff, some groundbreaking investigations to release, some really special contributors, and a brand new app that we've managed to get quite considerable funding for that we hope will change the way that news is presented in this country.
So why does this all matter?
why does it all matter? We need information to exist in a functioning democracy, I think. There's been a real closure of that information, and we get little peeks into getting the necessary information, but often the debate is within a very narrow band, and I think it's very important to widen the debate to give more people more access to information that's relevant to them, to the functioning of this democracy, and, you know, hopefully that can help us build a better world. I think it's the only way. We can't start building a better world from an uninformed position, and we've got a lot of huge challenges ahead of us that we need to tackle, I mean, right now.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, my name is Jane Hersey, and Breath in the Dark was not actually written as a book. I wrote a series of issues that I wanted my husband and son to understand why I was taken into psychotherapy, and how my childhood and early life had led me to having a lot of emotional problems. From the age of six, I was born in the Jewish community in Manchester, and from the age of six I was left to care for a mother who was suffering from depression, eating disorders and diabetes, which resulted from her psychological problems. My father had left, and because the Jewish community valued men and not women, my mother was blamed because my father left, and she was ostracized by her family. So even though I lived in the heart of the Jewish community with a lot of family surrounding me, I never met any of them. Well, met one.
But, I mean, how can some psychological problem lead to medical problem such as diabetes? That just sounds impossible.
Well, no, it's not. It's very possible. I mean, stress, depression, eating disorders, eating disorder led to my mother being diabetic. I'm in my early 60s now. I had an eating disorder, and I have a very sensitive stomach. So, you know, your psychological state can definitely impact on your physical well-being. I mean, people who are drinking alcohol to deal with stress, I mean, they're going to end up with physical problems. So it's not really unusual.
With Breath in the Dark, take us through some of the highlights or lowlights of that. I mean, what do you think is in there that other people may find echoes with?
Right, well, the thing that academics find of interest in the books, and it is being used by universities and academics, is the fact that when I left school, I couldn't, had no way of writing a story because I'd missed so much education because I was looking after my mother. Now, what they find of interest is the fact that I don't write based on anything I learnt in school. I write based on my emotions and my immediate experiences. So what they've said to me is that, you know, some of the academics have said that for many years we've worked with people who have suffered trauma, and the one thing they have in common is that they cannot articulate that. But I articulate the trauma by default because I didn't know how else to write. So as far as the books go, I think it gives a good insight into the devastating effect of being a child carer, of having to look after an adult, a parent, when the roles become reversed.
Okay, so you say the books, Breath in the Dark. What are the other books?
The other one's Full Circle. That actually starts when I'm left to care for myself. I'd left Manchester. I was in no fit state. I couldn't wash. I couldn't bathe. My coping mechanisms were one of neglect. So I found comfort because I'd been neglected for so many years. I actually found comfort in not washing, not bathing, in having skin infections, and I couldn't hold down a job. I got into a very bad relationship. I got pregnant straight away, and it was very abusive. I stayed in that relationship for 18 months until I was really in fear of my life and the life of my baby, and I left in the middle of the night, and there was no support at all.
Now, one of the most important things that we think of nowadays that social workers at least have at their disposal for vulnerable youngsters are children's homes. Did you have any experience of those? And if so, what do you make of them?
Well, the majority of children that go into care homes or who are in care suffer from mental illness. That's not because of just their adverse background. It's because of the ongoing stress. Children's homes are not good places to be, and there's no public outcry about this because the media presents vulnerable children as being bad. So if children go into care, it can only be because they're bad. And because of that, the public have very little interest. I mean, obviously, children are taken into care because family situations break down. You know, parents may be ill. Many different reasons, and more children are being taken into care now because of austerity cuts. Families are under pressure, families are breaking up, and children are being taken into care. But it's a terrible, terrible situation because they're pushed from pillar to post. Very rarely do they have a regular social worker, and worse than that is that the system doesn't acknowledge the trauma that they're going through. So they, as I was completely traumatized. I was just treated as though I had no intelligence and dismissed.
So what was your actual treatment within the children's homes? Were you cared for there?
Cared for, no. I mean, on several occasions I was sexually abused. There was food and there was a roof over your head. The nurse, the staff were known as nurses, so there was no, everything was, you were kept at a distance just by virtue of the fact that you had to call them nurse. There was no relationships, no understanding of what you were going through. And as I said, you were very vulnerable because, as is today, you know, you're vulnerable to being abused.
So how were you sexually abused under the noses, apparently, of these nurses?
Well, on one occasion, it was there were students who were coming to help, foreign students, and this was a female from Sweden, because it was in the Jewish community and these were Jewish children's homes and what have you. It wasn't under the noses. I mean, she was female. She took me to her room and sexually assaulted me on another occasion. It was another female nurse. This was in a different children's home. Now, this, I was 13. And this is actually in the book, that I was being, at the age of 13, I was being washed in a bath. I was being bathed by a nurse. And I wasn't actually being washed, if you see what I mean. But the thing is that, you know, a 13-year-old girl shouldn't be being washed by somebody. You know, maybe somebody could, you know, look on to make sure everything was okay, but certainly not being washed. But it's, you know, when you say under the noses of people, somebody takes you into a room, you know, other people who aren't paedophiles probably don't assume that anything bad's going to happen. You know, what can I say? You know, people find the way into these jobs where they feel, where they're dealing with vulnerable children.
So do you think poverty plays a role here too in making children vulnerable? Because it doesn't sound as if they're getting the protection, particularly, you know, your experience there.
Well, no, I mean, poverty is an enforced imprisonment for anybody. Very few people get out of poverty. And the majority of children who go into care who are being dealt with by social workers are going to be from poor backgrounds. Because, you know, if you have money and, you know, a situation arises at home where a parent goes into hospital, you know, you're probably going to have the extended family looking after them. So children in poverty are extremely at risk. And I read something not long ago that because of austerity cuts and poverty, there's a 40% increase in youngsters self-harming because they don't know how to cope with poverty, and schools, local authorities are cutting back their funding to help vulnerable children because of austerity. So it's, things are actually regressing. The welfare state, which was the only very meagre thing that people had, is being destroyed and nobody's doing anything about it.
Well, one group that is the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, even if it's only in informing us as how bad it's getting, Jane. Yes. They've just come out with a report that's saying that there's over a million people in Britain are now destitute. And when, by destitute, they define that as that they cannot afford basic essentials such as food, heating, clothing or toiletries, toilet paper, basic things like that. So certainly things aren't looking too good as regards people actually being able to pay for the basic things that they need in order to live. Obviously a big increase as well in evictions. Now, I wonder what you make of that and how it's, you know, the sort of wider effects of society.
Well, I personally find it disgusting. I spent a lot of time on Twitter, you know, trying to tell people to, you know, vote for a government who wasn't going to carry on austerity, who was going to realise, you know, the value of welfare. And even at the height of the welfare, my story was in the height of the welfare system, and it was still, you know, welfare is subsistence. The media portray it as being something there that, you know, enhances the life of people. It's subsistence to stop them from being destitute. But now we have a situation where people with mental illnesses are being sanctioned of the benefits, and they're, you know, mentally ill people. There's a rise in homeless mentally ill people. Well, this is disgusting, really. Absolutely disgusting. Welfare should be ring-fenced.
Also, I mean, worth pointing out that the High Court's just ruled that the government's sanctions regime is illegal, breaks the law. That is to say, cutting somebody off and living with absolutely no money to live on is apparently illegal.
This government have legislated. So, I mean, for example, with the NHS and social care, they've legislated so they no longer have a duty to provide care. So, you know, I've forgotten what the original point was, but, you know, we now have a government who is distancing themselves from people's needs. Sorry, just repeat that other point that you mentioned.
Yeah, I know you've written about eugenics. I wonder what that is. And it's one of those words that I'm never quite sure what it means. I think it wasn't it something to do with the Nazis? And you think that this have some relation to this idea of, you know, having people that simply are utterly destitute.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've actually got a link that that a psychologist in Sweden sent to me, and it's a very relevant link, and it says that eugenics remains a background influence in teaching psychology and psychiatry even today. And what eugenics is, and this is what is being practiced by this government, it's the notion that, you know, people are criminal. They're criminal and they're less than human if they are disabled, if they are poor, and that society doesn't owe them anything. Society's done enough for them, and now it's time to take that funding away, you know, and just let them go to the wall, because the eugenicists think that if people haven't got the strength to become wealthy, then they should just be left to die because they're of no value, and they will only contaminate the gene pool of the rest of society. So that is, you know, that's what's happening now. People with disabilities, people living in poverty, they're having everything taken away from them. And when you take everything, when you take little away from people who have got nothing, then they are going to become destitute. They are going to die.
So as someone who's Jewish yourself, I mean, what lessons are there from the past about what to do about all this?
Well, the only thing that you can do is hope that, you know, people will vote for people who don't want to carry on this legacy. Welfare was brought in for a reason, and, you know, to vote for a government, which people have done, that wants to destroy welfare is really saying, well, anybody who's vulnerable in society can rot. And this is what we're seeing, you know, an increase in destitution, homelessness, and even Amnesty condemned this government for their attack on disabled people. So, but sadly, there's no political challenge to it. There should be uprising. There should be, people should be out on the streets demanding an end to all this.
So I suppose, I mean, the thing is that you've got a Conservative government who knows that the people who are suffering at the hard end here, maybe particularly destitute, just simply don't have the resources to even get a roof over their head sometimes, let alone organise to have some sort of political change.
Well, that's right. But you see, well, yes, and this is where they are clever. These people are actually being taken out of the voting system as well. I mean, they've messed around. Cameron has messed around with the voting processes in parts of London, so that about a million people in London have lost the right to vote. And they know that if people are alienated and disenfranchised, they're not going to want to vote because they're depressed. You know, it's a very clever strategy that they have.
Well, you're painting a pretty worrying picture of eugenics and a serious erosion of any kind of real democratic checks and balances. How do you think we'll break it, or will it have to get worse before people do something?
Well, it will have to get worse, but my worry is that we have unions, we have an opposition political party, and nothing's happening. There's no challenge to it. You know, I find it absolutely appalling. We've become a sort of I'm all right, Jack, as long as I'm okay. Why should I have to pay my taxes, you know, to help more people more vulnerable? But a lot of people are finding that they're becoming vulnerable, and they're probably finding out what it's like not to have support. So.
Okay, Jane, can you just remind us of the titles of your books and how to get hold of them?
Yes, Breath in the Dark and Full Circle are available on Amazon. A lot of UK libraries actually have the books in stock as well. But they're in ebook, obviously, ebook and softback.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, and it's been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Barry Wynn, also author of Breath in the Dark, Jane Hersey and Thomas Barlow from Real Media. Also studio engineer Dave Pazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. You can call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. So, that was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Sweet silver angels over the sea, please come down, fly and low for me. One time I trusted a stranger, 'cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though was gone. Blinding me, his song remains, reminding me he's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker, sweet silver angels over the sea. Please come down, fly and blow for me. He wages war with the devil, a pistol by his side. And though he chases him out windows and won't give him a place to hide, he keeps his door open wide. Fighting him, he lights a lamp. In fighting him, he was a cross maker, sweet silver angels over the sea. Please come down, fly and blow for me. I hear the thunder come rumbling, the light never looks so dim. I see the junction get nearer, and danger is in the wind, and either rose looking grim. Me, I flee, desire to fight me. He's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker. Yes, Jesus was a cross maker. Sweet silver angels over the sea. Please come down, fly and blow. One time I trusted a stranger, cause I heard his sweet song, and it was gently enticing me, though there was something wrong. But when I turned, he was gone. Blinding me, his song remains, reminding me he's a bandit and a heartbreaker. Oh, but Jesus was a cross maker. Was a cross maker.